The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We're going to take a look at the story that was in the Sun Papers just recently on the... When was it in? It was just in on May 24th, on why police officers are not showing up in court for trials and why so many of them are trials being... Court cases being dismissed because of police officer no-shows, but there are a lot of dismissals. And we'll talk about that this hour. We invited everybody to join us. The state's attorney said they could not send anybody, but we did invite them to join this conversation. In the studio with us now are Charles Dorsey, who's an attorney with the Baltimore Public Defender's Office, Paige Croter, who's a former assistant state's attorney in Baltimore City and now blogs about criminal justice reform. You can read her blogs here on the SteinerShow.org website. And also Detective Bob Cherry is with us, who is president of the Fraternal Order Police Lodge 3 that represents the police officers in the city. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
So we'll be taking your calls here at 410-319-8888, joining us here for that conversation, your thoughts on all that. So this report that came out, I mean, it was one of the things the charts said. There were, so far this year, already 2,800 dismissals because of officers not showing up in court. Let's talk about, Paige, let me get your perspective first. On why you think this is taking place. And, I mean, you had how many years at the state attorney's office?
Almost 21.
21 years. Okay.
Well, first of all, it's nothing new. This is a story that first came into public view back in 2001, as the article in the Sun points out. I will notice that back then, State Attorney Jessamy said that failures to appear had reached a critical point. And according to the paper, that critical point was 2,100 cases, except that the same statistics published in the Sun show that they have been, the last 3 years, either over 3,000 or over 2,600. So, and yet you haven't heard a peep about that since really 2001, 2002. So I'm not sure why 2,100 was critical back then, and over 3,000 is not critical now. So there is something of a political element to publicizing the figures on police FTAs. However, so my only point is that police failing to appear in court is not a new issue. It's been something that's, you know, has been an issue ever since, I know, since I was prosecuting cases, which I began in 1987. However, it's a complicated issue. It's not so easy. It's not to say, well, the officer didn't show up, it's his fault, bad police officer. It's really more complex than that. Certainly there are police officers who consistently fail to appear in court. And, you know, a prosecutor who appears regularly in court came to know who they were. And that had to do with individual attitude, individual responsibility. There are plenty of officers who showed up on most of their cases. And if they didn't show up, there was usually a good reason. They were out on medical. They had requested vacation, and nobody had gotten that. They were on vacation, and nobody had gotten that information to ask for a postponement. They were serving, a lot of police officers serve in the reserve components, and, you know, they resigned from the force. So saying failure to appear doesn't always mean that it was the officer's fault. There's other complexities as well, but I'll give somebody else a chance to speak before I get into some of those.
Well, as I was reading the articles and seeing what people were saying, I mean, I didn't get the sense that that the State Attorney's Office was saying that there's not a crisis, or there was a crisis, just that, I mean, one of the things they were saying was that the gun cases were being served, the others were not being served as well. I mean, this year, according to the stats that were in the paper, last year there were 3,428 police officer no-shows in court. This year, and we're not even half a year through, is 2,642, which is if we keep going at that rate, then we could see one of the largest number of years ever of police officers not showing up in court. So
I think that figure was for all of 2008. 2,642.
2008. You're right.
They went down in 2008. But you also want to look at the difference between the district court and the circuit court. The district court had about 22% of cases were dropped for police officer FTA in the circuit court, which handled the more serious cases, the figure was 4.2% in 2008. So there seems to be a difference in police response for the more serious cases than for the less serious cases that you see in district court, which is one of the complexities that one of the issues I was going to talk about.
Bob Cherry?
No, I just, what I want to say, Mark, is I agree with Paige. I think that at least on the part where she says it's a complex issue, I don't think you can look at any of the cases, whether they're in district or circuit court, or for that matter, federal, and just look at it that the cases were dropped because a police officer didn't show up. It's definitely a lot more complex than that. And one of the things that our police department has done with the state's attorney's office, and this is where I would disagree with Paige, I think anytime you have police officers not showing up, whether it's a small amount or a large amount, it's always critical because the police officers are a very important component to making sure the case is able to go forward, although they're not the only component. And I think that's where Paige mentions that it's a lot more complex than just blaming it on police officer FTAs. But what we've done over the last year or so is we have seen a reduction in the percentage of court FTAs, both in district and circuit court. I think what we're seeing, though, is because of the increase in the arrests that, now Governor O'Malley, orchestrated back in 2001 under Commissioner Norris, our police officers are making more arrests, and therefore the volume of cases has increased. But I don't think that necessarily means that, officers are showing up at court at a much critical rate now than they were back in 2001.
Charles Royce, I know your job is to keep people out of jail.
That's correct.
So what's your perspective on this and your experience in the court?
My experience over the last 17 years is we've always had there are numerous reasons why police officers fail to appear. It was just mentioned that officers taking quantity over quality. We find that in a lot of cases that police officers fail to appear, the quality of the arrest and the case factor into whether they show up for court or not. Most of these cases that we're talking about, 22%, the district court cases, a lot of those cases are abated by the arrest.
And then we don't have an analysis here of this, but I've seen other analyses of arrests in the city and what they're for, and a lot of them are for crimes that we would look at as non-life-threatening crimes, and for lots of things, whether it's urinating in the street, drinking in the street, there's lots of people arrested for simple disorderlies, and these go to court, and whether the people have a record is not that the issue. The issue is people are being arrested. So I was wondering if maybe part of the issue, what you're saying, is if on some senses, police officers say, this case isn't really going anywhere, and I'm not going to waste my morning when I'm off coming to court. And whether that might also speak to the fact that maybe the volume of arrests, some of them are for arrests, maybe shouldn't start happening in the first place.
Go ahead.
I think the thing there, Mark, is when you say the arrest shouldn't happen in the first place, you got to remember, our police officers are out there every day and every night. And I know what Chip is saying, and I agree with some of the part there in terms of the officer looking at it like this is not serious. But if our officer receives a 911 call to show up at a location and there's a disorderly group, and then during the ensuing investigation or discussion with that group, everyone's moving but one person, and they challenge that officer and the officer makes an arrest, I don't know how you can blame that on the police officer who did their duty. They answered the 911 call. They responded. They were professional. They did their duty. Now they have a case where, a certain individual didn't want to move, and because of that, the failure to obey or disorderly, they're under arrest. And now subsequently, there's going to be a case that's going to come into the district court unless, and Paige has a lot more better information, and so does Chip on this, the state's attorney's office just decided now process at that point. And that does happen in district court. A lot of the cases are thrown out immediately when they first come in, and the officers know that.
Well, the dynamics have changed over the years since when I began prosecuting. It used to be that the officers did all the charging. They'd come in, the state's attorney and said, this was abated by arrest. Now those decisions are made up front, so a lot of those arrests are dropped at the beginning. So it should be in the prosecutor's discretion whether they're going to drop the case or not. And so officers who come to court with, or don't come to court with the attitude as, well, I'm going to abate this by arrest, I think that, and they do that. I agree with Chip that they absolutely do that. And I think I also agree with him that a number of those arrests are based on the fact that they were questionable to begin with. I think officers go out there and make, some officers go out there and make some what they call humble arrests, which if somebody on the street defies them, they lock them up. But they don't come down to court to justify what they did. I find those arrests and their failure to come to court particularly upsetting. I find officers who don't come to court when there's a victim involved, like the article in the paper, person's car was broken into, jewelry stolen, who don't come to court when there's a victim involved, particularly upsetting. I think perhaps the victimless offenses, which are minor cases, which do go to court. A lot of those cases come out of early resolution court. If they're not resolved there, they go on to trial. Officers may not come at that point, considering them abated by arrest. That may explain a lot of those arrests, too. They don't bother me so much. But when you have a victim involved, or if you have an officer who is throwing his weight around, making a questionable arrest, and does not come to court to justify that arrest, I have a problem with that, as well as, of course, with serious cases.
Charles?
Well, I'm talking to a lot of our clients. The mandate seems to be to get the guns off the street. And so a lot of times our clients are stopped and may be arrested, and they're talked to, and they say, look, tell me where a gun is, and I'll get rid of the case. And so what I'm saying is that the substance of the arrest is questionable, but the investigation, what the officers are looking for, help me find somebody who's selling drugs. Sometimes our clients work with the police. Sometimes our clients don't know anything about that. So that, you know, it is a complicated situation, but and that has that affects whether a lot of police officers come to court on certain cases. Some cases our clients are working to assist an officer in some other case. In another case, I'll talk to my client and he says, look, you know, I didn't do anything. And he just said, give me a gun and I'll let you off. So it's with such a strong mandate to get the guns off on the street, and it puts a lot of stress on the police officers to produce.
Go ahead, Bob.
No, I mean, I think Chip, you know, hit something there. The priority of Commissioner Biefeld and the police department is handguns. And actually, I would say that that priority even goes prior to Commissioner Biefeld. And again, it's not just the commissioner uses the terms bad guys with guns a lot. And I think actually the term he should be using is bad guys, period, because there are a lot of bad guys out there who carry knives and other weapons that are just as much of a threat to our city and our citizens than those carry handguns. But as Chip mentioned, that is the priority right now. This police department, our offices are under a lot of pressure to go out there and fulfill their duty and get the job done. From an FOP perspective and also as a former homicide detective, I know how important it is to get the citizens involved, to have civilian witnesses to cooperate with our police department. You know, on the homicide, robbery, shooting end, we need civilians to trust the police to come forward. And so, you know, when I'm out there talking to the younger officers, you know, I do remind them that even though the priority of the police department is violence and handguns, you know, keep in mind that every person you come into contact with will someday potentially be not only a member of the jury, but could also be a potential civilian witness that we're going to need to get, as Paige referred to earlier, the more critical cases, the defendants who are out there committing murder, shootings, robberies, that we want those folks to also come to court. And I think that's what's going to be mentioned here, too. I mean, you know, the Sun points to court FTAs amongst police officers, but I think both, you know, Paige and Chip realize this, that a lot of the stuff that occurs also is our civilians who don't come into court. It's not just the police officers. You know, I've been in court many times, 2, 3, 4 times, where the state's attorney, you know, are ready to go. The police officers are there. The evidence is there. And you just can't find this certain witness. And we're working hard to get those people in. I mean, the police officer is not just responsible for their own showing up and their own testimony, they got to get the evidence out of evidence control. It's been a long-standing practice in Mrs. Jessamy's office that the arresting officer or detective is responsible as well to bring in the civilian witnesses. So there's a lot of work on our offices besides just making the arrest to make sure that we have a successful conclusion in the court level. And I think that needs to be noted.
I ran the statistics for the last three quarters of 2008. These are statistics that are passed out, you know, by the state attorney's office.
Mm-hmm.
And in the circuit court, the officers, the officers were FTA in about 4% of the cases, the witnesses in over 13% of them. In the district court, the police officers 22%, but the witnesses 18%. So what, you know, Detective Cherry says is correct. I mean, witnesses, whether they be police officers or civilians, are the number one reason why cases are dropped. However, I think the citizens have a right to expect that witnesses, that police witnesses, are not going to be in that category, because you make an arrest, you should be in court. But in addition to attitude towards perhaps types of cases, I think it really is difficult for officers to be present every single time. When you talk about the district court, that is essentially a postponement and probation court. It gets postponed until you finally have a set of circumstances where everybody's there and the judge isn't going to give any more postponements. And then if they get probation, they'll take the plea. And if they don't, they go down to the circuit court where there's more postponements. So you'll come in, the defense will almost regularly, the defendant will almost regularly ask for a postponement to get a lawyer, even if he's been advised of his rights. He may get two postponements to get a lawyer. And then he'll come down, and then maybe the defense attorney, you know, if it won't be ready or whatever. There are usually multiple postponements. And keeping up, and the officer keeping up with all of that and appearing every single time, I think is difficult. I think it's logistically difficult, the way the court system works.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Maybe you've been a witness who to a crime and have difficulty getting to court. Maybe you have been a victim and find that no police officer's there. Maybe you're a lawyer who's had that experience. Maybe you're a police officer who wants to talk about why it is that people don't appear if you're police officers and what that does to our court system. We're doing this as a result of the article that appeared in The Sun about officers' failure to appear in certain trials. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You just heard Paige Kreuter, who spent 21 years as a state's attorney, now blogs on criminal justice reform. You can read her blog at the SteinerShow.org website. Bob Cherry is a detective, Bob Cherry Jr., president of the FOP Lodge number 3. Here in Baltimore City, and Charles Dorsey is an attorney with the Baltimore Public Defender's Office. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So I wonder then if some of the, going back to some of the reasons here and what this might all portend. I mean, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about the kinds of arrests and whether there just are, in some cases, arrests that make very little sense, either to, once they're booked, whether it's just from the state's attorney's side, the police side, and people just don't post for lots of reasons around that issue. And we've just, that the arrests are up, but, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but the stats that I saw last time, there were a lot of people being arrested for lots of charges that maybe didn't require an arrest, at least just looking statistically. I don't know anything about the individual cases. But is that part of the problem? Are we making too many unnecessary arrests in the streets of Baltimore?
We can always look at what kind of arrests we're making, Mark, but I think that to be fair to the public and to your, you know, listenership, I think that they need to also hear that even though the arrests may be up and you're looking at the quality of arrests or the type of arrests we're making, I think it's important to point out that, you know, our police officers have gone out there and we've come a long way from the mid-90s when homicides were 340, 350 a year, when we had over 1,000 shootings, when robberies were, you know, through the roof. And I think that's important. Do we have a long way to go? Absolutely. Is the police department responsible for looking at some of these arrests that can be abated actually at the scene and not, as, you know, Charles says, bringing these clients, his clients into court unnecessarily so? Absolutely. And that goes back to training. But I think our police department and our offices are committed to training. They're committed to their duty and they go out there and they're doing their job. And I think that's reflective on the reduction in the numbers of murders, shootings, and robberies over the last 10 years. And I think that's the stuff that we need to look at as we move forward.
Charles Dorsey?
I would disagree a little bit with what Paige said about a plea and postponement court. I would say the court system in the district court has turned into a plea, postponement, and a dismissal.
I just left that out. We agree.
Because there's so many arrests now that, you know, you spend a third of the cases that just end up being dismissed for numerous reasons, whether it's a bad arrest or somebody doesn't show up for numerous reasons. But there's so much pressure on the Baltimore City Police Department at this particular time, not only because of the economic situation and the stress and the funding, but before they used to be able to, like, get paid to come to court. Now it's set up with a police liaison where they're asked to, a lot of times, show up to court and they're on duty. For instance, the state's attorney will say, well, my officer's working and available. That officer is asked to work and be available to come to court at the same time. That puts an awful lot of pressure on an officer. And, he may be doing something more important at that particular time, investigating a robbery or murder than showing up for court at that particular time.
I'm going to open the phone to you, but I want to come back and kind of go to the heart of what's amiss in the coordination inside of our criminal justice system and how things can work better, A, and B, ask maybe what you might consider a little bit off-the-wall question about different ways of adjudicating certain cases that may not need to come to court to begin with. Just thinking maybe outside the usual way that we do things in our criminal justice system. But let me open the phones first. 410-319-8888. We're here with Charles Dorsey, Paige Kreuter, and Detective Robert Cherry, Jr. We're talking about police, no shows in court, but it's beyond that. It's a whole question of coordination in the state of our criminal justice system. 410-319-8888. Eric in Northeast Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Mark, and to your panel. And I'm calling as a regular citizen in Baltimore City, and I can account for, on one hand, where I have had motor vehicle accidents in Baltimore City. The police showed up. They were involved in making a record of the report. For me, they were no-fault accidents. And within the past 7 years, when my cases went to the district court, where the police officer was served with a subpoena to come to court, was contacted the day before by phone by the attorney who was representing me, on three occasions over the past 7 years, they still failed to appear in district court without any good reason as to why they didn't show up. They just did not show up.
Did you say civil court or criminal court?
This was civil. I said motor vehicle accident.
Okay, I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, I understand there's always extenuating circumstances, but I see it as a perception, as a citizen, as a trend. You know, not an exception, but a trend. And I think it's a sad commentary on the state of the policing in the city based on my experiences that I had from my perspective. And that's the comment I just wanted to make.
Eric, it's interesting. Bob Cherry, go ahead.
Yeah, Eric, let me ask you this, if you're still on the line. Did our police officer, did they witness your motor vehicle accident?
Again, the deciding factor in my favor, because it was a no-fault accident for me, because of the testimony that was given to the police officer at the scene, the other driver admitted fault.
So what was your, but
the issue is that he needed the officer to impeach the other witness. Bob's question was, did the officer think he had firsthand information to impart, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so the officer was needed to impeach the other witness, or to at least say that the other witness had admitted fault.
That's correct.
And didn't appear. And extremely frustrating.
Very frustrating. And it's a trend.
So, and if this is Eric's perception also, that it's a trend, and then we see the numbers that have come back, at least for 2008, 2007, and before, that, I mean, this is also part and parcel of maybe people's reluctance to trust the court system. I mean, when people come with a case and they want to be, they have their want to have their rights upheld, they want to have their case vindicated, they want to have their day in court, so somebody has to see the person who has done a criminal act against them, prosecuted, and then they're not prosecuted. Witnesses not showing up because they fear coming to court. I mean, there's a dilemma here of trust, I think, in the system, and this just exacerbates it.
I did some court watching in the month of April, and one of the courtrooms I was sitting in fact, I wrote a blog about this, about what's happening in our traffic courts. But I sat there and watched a judge take what I consider to be serious traffic cases, drunk driving, people driving repeatedly on suspended license who shouldn't be, do nothing to these people in the sense of it was probation, probation on top of probation, and so forth. And the police officers were sitting in their pews, watching their pews, looks like pews, benches.
Pews.
Yeah, and their benches in the court. And I grabbed one of them when they came out, and I said, you know, I'm frustrated sitting here watching this. How do you feel? I mean, do you even feel like coming to court? That's how I felt. And he said, I wrote down his quote, well, we all know that the court system is basically useless, is what he said.
And you think that's true with the person who's basically useless?
I could see why he had that perception when I watched what was going on in the courtroom. Then he went on to say, however, we can't fight City Hall. We don't take it personally. Most of us are thinking just that we want to go home because we're on the midnight shift. And I want to come back to that. He was there. He was on the midnight shift. You have to understand, and I know I would be, if I was the gentleman who called, as frustrated as he is, but you have these officers who are expected to be in district court, in circuit court, on serious cases, on minor cases, and now obviously in civil cases as well, and they can't be in all of these places all the time.
But I wonder if there's an attitude that our criminal justice system is just not working, whether you're a police officer going, the courts don't work, or whether it's a citizen saying, the courts don't work and the police don't work and I don't want to be part of it, whether it's the witnesses saying, I'm not going to testify and get myself in trouble for the people in my neighborhood, I'm not coming, that we have a problem here, and we have a problem in the way our criminal justice system is working. I think both for defendants, for people who have been arrested who are defendants, for people who have been victims of crime, for everyone. I mean, it just does not seem to be functioning on some levels that in a city like ours. Now, I want to come back and tackle that, but first when we come back, we're going to go right to Jeffrey in Northeast, another caller. We'll get his call as we return. We're talking with Charles Dorsey from the Public Defender's Office, Paige Quarter, former state's attorney, Bob Cherry, who's president of the FOP Lodge number 3, 410-319-8888. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you and made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We're talking about the problem of police no-shows in courts and cases being dismissed and the complexity and all that. There's more than just simply police officers not wanting to show up. I think most of us are clear about that, but what really is it? What lies underneath of it, what can be done to reform that, and the issues facing our criminal justice system. Joining us in studio are Detective Robert Cherry, Jr. Bob Cherry is president of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 3, which is the Baltimore City Lodge. Paige Quarter is a former assistant state's attorney who now blogs on district criminal justice reform. You can read it at the SteinerShow.org site. Charles Dorsey is attorney in the Baltimore Public Defender's Office, and you are the folks who are the citizens of this community at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Jeffrey in Northeast Baltimore, you're on the air.
How you doing? I'd like to say good evening first.
Good evening.
I have sort of a question and a comment. I am a retired state employee. And about a year ago, I was coming out of an alley that I put my trash in, actually, and was accused of public urination. I was written a citation. I went to court, and it was what they call non-process or something of that nature.
Non-process, yeah.
And I thought that was the end of it. And I was checking my, actually applying for a gun permit. And I see where my record says that I have been arrested for public urination. So somehow it's a part of my record, and I never even went to court for it. I mean, I thought that was the end of it, but now I seem to have a record consisting of that.
It is in a record. You need to have it expunged off of your record. And usually when cases are nolprost in court, that's one of the things that the public defender's office will advise an individual, that they can go directly to any district court clerk office. I think it's a fee of $30 and get it expunged off the arrest off of your record. And so that's the procedure there.
Even though it was never proven or for trial, I still have to go through that process.
You want to get the arrest taken off of your record. The record states that your case was dismissed, but you can go and get the arrest expunged off of your record, and that's the.
I guess what he's incredulous about is that if he was arrested and it was nolprost, he was never even went to court for it, that there should even be arrest on his record in the first place is what he's saying.
When you get arrested, it's going to be a record of your arrest. You know, the thing that concerns the public defender's office is that we find that it's very unfair that a case will be dismissed and the defendant still has to come up with the money to pay to get his record cleared. And we have a problem. That doesn't make any sense.
All right, Jeff, I hope that helps you, and I would just fork up the $30 to get that off my record as much as it's distasteful to you.
Right.
All right.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care now. Take care.
Mark, I'd like to go back, if I may, to what Paige was saying in the beginning of the conversation when the four of us started here. She talked about the complexity of the issue, and I think for the listeners out there, I think that's the key term here, and I know you want to talk about some of the issues in court, some of these inconsequential arrests that may or may not have to be made in the first place. I think that's what we need to be discussing here is not just police FTAs, but the overall complexity of the problem that incorporates the entire court and judicial system. But having said that, I would like to give the public some other numbers in addition to the numbers Paige gave us. And these numbers I was able to get from the Mayor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention as it relates to police FTAs, since this was the subject of your conversation today. The numbers that we were getting is that overall failure to appears, there was a reduction of 23% in district court and a reduction in 30% from the year 2007 to 2008. And then when we talk about the gun cases, as Chip mentioned even earlier, that's the priority of Commissioner Bierfeld and this police department. And again, it needs to be, because we're losing lives out there in our city streets. And we look to our police officers to stem and stop the bleeding. Well, the gun cases, our officers have a 56% reduction in district court and a 75% reduction in failure to appears in circuit court from the year 2007 to 2008. So even though I think we need to begin and expand this dialogue into the overall system, I think the public need to keep in mind that the police officers are out there doing their job. They work long hours. Some of our specialized offices in the Violent Crime Impact Division are on permanent 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. shifts. When you get home at 4:30 in the morning, you're saying goodnight to your wife and your kids. It's hard to get up and turn around. We're not justifying an FTA, but we have reduced FTAs from 07 to 08. We're going to continue to reduce it, and more importantly, our office is going to continue to do what they're asked to do, which is make Baltimore a safer and stronger city.
I think you can see the police are sort of self-selecting which cases they're going to go to and probably doing it correctly in the disparity between their FTA rates at district court and at circuit court. However, they do fail to appear at circuit court, and there have been people, they have failed to appear on serious cases, and those have absolutely got to be eliminated, just eliminated.
So the question, well, I want to ask how we eliminate them. But let's go to the phones first. 410-319-8888. Jerome, on your cell phone, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Well, Jerome. Thanks for joining me.
I've always taken an interest in law enforcement in Baltimore City. And one thing I can say, that the police officer that's supposed to be patrolling the beat in Baltimore City, they're harassing people. In these cases, they don't come to court because they don't want to be charged with perjury for ridiculous arrest. You got people sitting over central booking. They got standing room only in district courts because of these police that don't even live in Baltimore. I told the police commissioner before, they live out of state. They live in Pennsylvania, and they are literally harassing these poor people. They're charging them and dropping them off at central booking, and then they won't come to court to testify because they look stupid. What they need, put cameras in these cars, and they'll stop all of this nonsense. Nobody will put cameras in these cars to take a ride herd on these police. I'll listen to your response.
Okay.
I think it's wrong.
Charles Joseph, you're in the middle of defending these cases all the time. Absolutely. How real to you is what Jerome is saying?
It's very real. We have numerous cases that officers make questionable statement of charges. I don't know whether it's a serious crime area where the officers want these people off of that corner, or you know, they're trying to get information from these individuals. But we have a lot of cases where officers have done some what we consider to be some questionable things. Our clients go to internal affairs, take out an investigation, and then those officers don't show up in court, and those cases end up being dismissed, which gives our clients credibility of what they are saying is happening in their communities. So we've noticed a large amount of cases like that. And once again, I think it comes down to, once again, we're in a tough situation in the city with the crime rate, the violent crime rate, and the pressure that we put on the Baltimore City Police Department to have results.
Go ahead, Bob Cherry.
Yeah, back to what Paige was saying in terms of eliminating the problem of the serious cases and police officer FTAs. She made a good point, and we need to not just further reduce police officer failure to appear, but eliminate that. And Paige is correct with that. And you asked, well, what do we do about it? And I think that one of the things that need to be brought up is that the police department is working or is attempting to work with the state's attorney's office now on doing like a form of an electronic summons that can be forwarded to our offices via their mobile phone or their email. Currently, we're still unfortunately using the paper summons, and many offices, just so the public understand how that works, you know, once an arrest is made and the clerk of the courts identify, you know, a court date and time and identify the witnesses to include the police officer witnesses, the paper summons will be distributed to that office's command. In our police department, our offices are moving around constantly from one division to another, from one command to another. The summonses may get lost. The clerks at the district or the command level may not have filed it properly or right away. It may be put in another book. And so for a lot of reasons, the paper summonses may be one of the reasons why our offices are showing up as well. So to answer your question, how we can eliminate or further reduce court FTAs, the police department is working on that. And our police officers, again, I have to stress, are very committed to showing up in court and testifying and letting the public know that they don't just want to make an arrest; they want to follow through with a proper conviction.
No, I know that is not an easy thing to this chair. Got to move this chair and get a new one. It's not an easy thing to answer given the positions that, you know, both you have had and that you have, Bob, and what you were just raising a minute ago, Charles Dorsey. But I wonder how many, at least in the circuit court, of the no shows have to do with what the last caller was talking about that we raised earlier, in the kinds of arrests being made that shouldn't be done in the city. That we are so hell-bent on stopping crime, as we should be. Nobody wants violent crime. Nobody wants a bunch of thugs on the corner destroying people's lives every day and people's way of life and quality of life. Those are very real issues. You know, and I think there are a lot of times people who are criticizing that, I mean, they don't have to live on a street corner where a bunch of thugs or threatening people or people feeling threatened by people on the corner. I mean, that's just very real. So I'm not diminishing that. But what I'm saying is that there's a lot of argument that because of the push we have for arrests in Baltimore, that there are too many arrests that don't need to be arrests, and that we don't have a system in this city that can adjudicate neighborhood issues and deal with neighborhood issues in ways other than arrest. And that may be part of the problem why the jails are filling up, why the courts are so backed up, one of the reasons, and why officers don't post for trials because they know the court case is specious to begin with and it's a waste of their time.
But, Mark, you know, you can't have it both ways, though, and I think you know that.
You can't have what both ways?
You say on one level that, you know, we need about these arrests. You know, when I'm out there and I'm talking to citizens in the street, and I know there's a lot of frustration, and a lot of people use the word harassment and unnecessary arrests,
yep.
But there's just as many people out there, and to use President Nixon's term, the silent majority, there's a lot of folks out there who are taxpayers, who are, you know, hardworking homeowners in Baltimore City, who grew up here their entire life, whether it be East, West Baltimore, who are just as frustrated when our police officers may pull up to a corner and just drive right by. And I've heard them say, I've called 911 two, three, four times today, and that officer just gets out of the car, waves these guys off, and is not doing anything. So, the police officer, unfortunately, is always put right in the middle. You know, the laws that we're enforcing are the laws that the legislature put on the books.
Okay. I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think that that's one of the reasons one of the places I was remiss is that somebody maybe I should invite to this panel today, maybe do the next time we come on, is Doc Cheatham from the NAACP. I mean, his.
But what you also mean.
Well, wait a minute, because I mean, there's certain kind of viewpoints about where the city is that kind of need to be heard a lot, which is. And I agree with you. Look, there are a lot of bad guys in the street. And I'm the first one. I mean, then they got to be off the street. There's no question about it. But what I'm saying is I think that maybe it is the way our entire system is structured, how we go after people who we consider the bad guys, what we do with minor crimes. We have no system other than arrest, and maybe that is part of our problem. I mean, part of the problem is how we run the system and what the police are put in a position to do, because that's your job, and you end up making arrests that maybe you shouldn't be making. And I think that there's pressure on the state attorney's office to do those kinds of arrests and everybody else, and we're not thinking different ways of doing things.
All right, let me just make a couple of comments. First, you said about inviting Doc Cheatham. I would say that rather than all the usual suspects, you get some of the community leaders, citizens groups here, not community leaders, but citizen groups, the ones who are in, you know, Sharp Leadenhall or in, you know, Cherry Hill or where East or West Baltimore, wherever they're having, you know, problems with people on the corners dealing drugs and the impact they have on their community, to get that particular point of view. We do hear the point of view about the police harassing, and I understand that too. But as Bob pointed out, there is that other view. The reason the police are there are usually in response to community complaints. I would also say that a lot of these cases, these questionable arrests that are made to clear the corner because they won't leave, or that you're trying to get information out, a lot of them wash out either at the charging level or the first date in the district court. Now, that's not, I don't think, a good use of court resources. However, they do wash out usually early on. You said how many of them get down to the circuit court. I don't think that many of those type of cases get down to the circuit court.
I meant district court, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I said circuit, but I meant district.
Okay.
And then they open the phone and say, the lines are now full, tons of people have called in, and I want to get them on the air with us. But, Charles, please go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I think that we need to have more of a balance. Just because a kid has a T-shirt and shorts doesn't make him a bad guy. And what we do is we alienate these kids because they feel like they haven't done anything wrong, and then they have bad feelings towards the police department. So it has to be a balance. That we have to find.
We only have a few minutes. We have a lot of people there, and I'm looking at the call list that just literally popped up in the midst of this conversation we're having right now. And oddly enough, one of the callers calling in is Doc Cheatham. Mm-hmm. So let me let Doc come on the air, and Doc can even stay with us while we get the other callers on. Doc, you there?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm great, and great conversation. I think our biggest challenge is for at least three different entities to, I don't want to say accept blame, but we need to do better in accepting that we all have some responsibility in making this process better. And what we've not done, and instead of us trying to immediately be defensive as to who's blamed, I think all of us have to accept responsibility that the system is not working in a manner that's pleasing to all of us. What we have not done is to sit down and say, here are the problems. How can we best work these problems out? We have not done that. I think we spend too much time defending ourselves and pointing fingers at one another when I contend we all have some responsibility and blame.
Well, Doc, you want to stay on the line with us for a bit?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
We only have like 5 minutes, but let me get some of the callers in here. And 410-319-8888. Denise, you're on the air.
I just wanted to find out if the system, the police department, is using any forms of restorative justice, like community mediation, in terms of dealing with crimes like you talked about that don't necessarily require arrest. Because I think that that's a good way of looking at and dealing with some of these issues and talking and dealing with healing and people working with each other as opposed to throwing people in jail and throwing away the key and young, you know, that kind of thing. I wanted to hear more about that.
Denise, I think that's a subject I think would be interesting to have a panel on the show discuss. And I think that, and having some of the same people on this panel, including Doc and the people in this room and others, to talk about alternative ways of addressing what we face. And that's what I'm talking about. I mean, if we had a system in this city of restorative justice, of community mediation, that was as prevalent as we have arrests. Now, I don't know I didn't phrase that quite right, but then we may be kind of getting to a root of how to deal with problems we see in the streets that resolve issues without arrests and without clogging up the courts. And that's what I'm talking about, Bob Cherry.
No, and you're right, Mark, and so is President Cheatham. I think that Doc Cheatham makes a good point. You know, rather than keep pointing fingers and looking for blame, like your listener just called in about mediation, that obviously brings in the state and the Department of Juvenile Justice and their role and, you know, what their caseworkers are doing in terms of making sure that our children, you know, are home at night for a curfew, they're getting up and going to school in the morning. We all have a role here. We all have a responsibility to play. And I think, like President Cheatham says, just pointing fingers at the police department isn't the answer. We all need to step up, admit where we're wrong, look for some alternatives so that we can continue to make Baltimore safer and stronger.
We have a reactive system. I mean, it's not just peculiar to Baltimore. I just think that politicians everywhere are reactive, and they react to blame. So when a police officer handcuffs a six-year-old and it's all over the paper, there's going to be defensiveness. There's going to be internal tweaking. When the arrests go up and the community gets outraged, there are going to be town hall meetings and there'll be some tweaking of policies. But I think what's needed is a sort of a willingness to look at the whole system and almost to start again. In my view, for example, the district court is a colossal waste of money. And I could do, you know, many shows on why I think that is.
Well,
but you want me to wrap that up? But what I'm saying is that start from ground zero and let's look at how to handle things differently.
We have about 30 seconds left. Doc Cheatham, I want to invite you on for the next show we do about this and maybe have the same panel and others on. I think it's at the level that all of you are on with the discussion that's take place in this community about a different way of dealing with justice. Maybe we can be a shining light for the rest of the nation if we can figure it out. Doc, thanks for hanging on, and I look forward to having you on as a guest very soon.
Take care. Great show.
Thank you. And to Paige Kreuter, thanks for taking the time and putting burrs under people's saddles. And Bob Cherry, good to have you in the studio. Thank you for responding so often.
Charles
Dorsey, thank you so much as well for fighting the people's fight in the courts. It's good to have you here as well. We're going to take, before we go to a break at the top of the hour, it's time for On This Day in Our History. Stay with that, and we'll come back with our next hour. On this day in history, May the 28th.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you.
First, I gotta say happy birthday to Gladys Knight, who was born on this day, May 28th, in 1944. When she recorded Every Beat of My Heart in 1962, I was one of those 16-year-old boys who dropped to his knees. Years later, I had a chance to interview her, and my heart skipped a beat. Would there be life without Gladys Knight and the Pips? 48 years ago, on this day, May 28th, 1961, Amnesty International was created. British lawyer Peter Berenson wrote an article on the front page of the London Observer that launched an appeal for amnesty 1961. It called for the release of all people imprisoned throughout the world who were held in prisons simply for peaceful expression of their ideas and beliefs. It all began after Berenson read an article about two Portuguese students who were arrested and imprisoned for raising their glasses to freedom. Portugal then was in the vice-like grip of a vicious fascist dictatorship ruled by Antonio Salazar. He urged readers to write letters demanding the release of those students. It was then that the term prisoner of conscience was coined, and it launched an international movement for freedom of speech, religion, and ideas that is still growing to this day. Amnesty International won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. Its battle for human rights was spawned by the deep belief in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, that fundamental rights go beyond all borders and transcend any political, ideological, cultural, religious, or cultural systems or beliefs. They now have 2.2 million members in 150 countries and are expanding that belief in human rights to include the end of poverty. On this day in 1863, the 54th Infantry Regiment left Boston to go south to fight the Confederacy. For 2 years, President Abraham Lincoln refused to let black men fight in the Civil War. Whites in the Union were terrified at the idea of armed black men, in or out of uniform. It took Frederick Douglass to convince President Lincoln that no one had more at stake in this fight than African Americans. The Union needed troops desperately, so the order was given. Former slaves, escaped slaves, and freedmen alike volunteered in droves to be soldiers in the United States Colored Troops. The 54th was the most famous black regiment. The white abolitionist and Civil War combat veteran Robert Gould Shaw became its commander. Two sons of Frederick Douglass and the grandson of Sojourner Truth fought with the 54th. On this day in 1863, the 54th set sail for Port Royal, North Carolina. They fought from the moment they hit land, fighting through Georgia, stopping Confederates' attacks on Charleston, South Carolina, and volunteering for a doomed attack on Fort Wagoner, where they suffered devastating heavy casualties, including their commander, Robert Shaw. The 54th left no doubt that blacks would fight for their freedom, and left no doubt that freedom would be theirs. On this day in 1888, the man who many say was the greatest athlete in American history was born in a log cabin in Indian Territory, now known as Oklahoma. His name was Jim Thorpe. He was a Sauk, Fox, Potawatomi Indian, who was the grandson of the great chief Black Hawk. He, like a lot of Indian children, were stolen and kidnapped from their parents and sent to Indian schools in the East to have the Indian beaten and disciplined out of them to fit into the white world. He was sent to the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. He left school to play baseball in North Carolina. Then he came back to play baseball, football, basketball, and ran track there. In the 1912 Olympics, he won gold medals in both the decathlon and the pentathlon. They were later stripped from him because he was paid a few dollars to play baseball in North Carolina. He went on to be voted first-string All-American football halfback, scoring 198 points in one season, including 22 points of 27 points in a game against a West Point team that included Dwight David Eisenhower. He played for the National League champion New York Giants baseball team, became president of the new American Professional Football League. But broke and beleaguered during the Depression, he couldn't even afford a ticket to the 1932 Olympics, but was invited to sit in the presidential box. When he arrived, the crowd of 105,000 stood up spontaneously to cheer him. In his life, he was maligned, ridiculed as an Indian, and died in poverty, but always with his head held high and always an American champion. So on this day, May 28th, let's not forget other birthdays as well. Dr. Betty Shabazz, activist and wife of Malcolm X, was born in 1936. Roald Dahl was born in 1916, went on to write Charlie's Chocolate Factory. And the great blues guitarist T-Bone Walker was born on this day as well. So happy birthday to all born on this day. And that was just a little of what happened on this day, May 28th. There's nothing wrong with you that a good shuffle boogie won't cure.